Mallow and Doe Harris.
And welcome back to the Faceless Men podcast covering HBO's Game of Thrones television series. I'm your host, Michael.
And I'm your host, Jesse.
And we'd like to thank the person who does our intro and outro music, Remix Fix. You can find them on soundcloud.com/remix-fix. You can also find us on facebook.com/facelessmencast, at facelessmencast on Twitter. On Google Plus, just search for Faceless Men Podcast. And if that was too much for you, just go to madbrewlabs.com and find the link at the top, Faceless Men Podcast, which has links to all the aforementioned places. So, Jesse, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate this most recent Game of Thrones episode?
I think I'd give it probably a 6 or 7.
Yeah, I'd probably give it a 7. 6 or 7. Yeah, I'd probably. You know, middling.
Yeah. I wasn't super impressed with it, but I also wasn't disappointed either.
So this episode is called Oathkeeper. The director was Michelle MacLaren. Michelle returns from last season. She directed Bear and the Maiden Fair and Second Sons. She has a lot of cred here in television production. She's been a producer and or director for Breaking Bad, X-Files, Night Stalker, which was the Kolchak remake, The Walking Dead, Hell on Wheels, and many more. The teleplay is written by Brian Cogman, who's a Game of Thrones alumnus. He's written an episode for every season, I believe. Notable episode is Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things from season 1, What is Dead May Never Die from season 2, and Kissed by Fire from season 3. What's interesting is that it doesn't seem to be losing any steam as far as viewership goes. The ratings on this one actually jumped higher than the season premiere. According to Entertainment Weekly, the Nielsen ratings for this episode was 6.9 million.
It's a good thing they signed on for a couple more seasons.
Yeah, is that crazy or what? So if the last episode put people off, it didn't put very many off. Maybe it put some off and then attracted some more. Diving into the episode, we have the opening credits. There's nothing new there. And we go straight to Meereen.
The first scene here is Missandei teaching Grey Worm to read. Yet, I don't think I've ever seen him speak just Dothraki. He's been speaking pretty good common so far throughout the entire everything.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he's been speaking common the whole time or if it's just been translated.
Well, he probably wasn't speaking it, but they probably did for these, so they didn't have to put the...
Oh, so you're saying that they probably did that so they wouldn't have to show subtitles?
Yeah, and now that it's convenient to do so.
While Missandei, is that her name? Missandei?
I believe so.
Missandei? I don't know.
I don't know how to pronounce it. That looks correct.
I will write these names down, and I'll hear it during the episode, but as soon as I commit it to paper, I automatically put my own pronunciation on it. So I apologize, listeners. While Missandei's teaching Grey Worm how to read...
It seems like he's asking her about where she's from, and she's responding. I think she said she was from the Summer Isles, or was that...
Yeah, I didn't catch where each person was from. They were both from some island.
Yeah, Summer Isles. I thought it was Summer Isles.
She said that she was from some island. She's used the word island, but when he was reading his name and place of birth, I guess, that was some isle, right?
Yeah.
Because he wanted to pronounce it Isley.
Yep.
Or Issel. It's strange how the Game of Thrones common tongue is spelled in English.
Interesting.
But he says something interesting because he's like, unsullied, always unsullied. Before unsullied, nothing. Because, you know, that takes us back to the fact that these kids were ripped away from their parents when they're children, right?
Babies, like infants, babies, right?
Yeah, when they were babies, and they were trained from birth to be these warriors. He also says something else, you know, he's like, he says it in, I don't know, it's not Dothraki, is it? It's Valyrian, right?
I do not know on that one. I know that in the books they were, at least as far as I got, they're mostly speaking Dothraki, but I'm not sure, I didn't get that far.
Okay, so whatever foreign language they're speaking in, he says something, and then she says it in the common tongue, kill the masters.
That seems to be a theme around Dany's entire campaign right now.
Do you think that will ever come back to haunt her? This whole, you know, because he's all about kill the masters. You notice that when she walked in, they stand upright. Like, whatever they were talking about was, you know, maybe they shouldn't be talking about.
Yeah. She clearly doesn't give a shit. Like, she burned that one guy with the dragon.
Well, I wonder if there's at some point Dany will stop being the breaker of chains and transform into another master. Is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Technically, she already is, right? She's leading them.
She's leading them, but they all had a choice.
Yeah, they all had a choice, and they still do.
They still do for now. But what I'm saying is, as this storyline develops, because we've seen all sorts of characters change.
You're saying, is Dany going to become a tyrant?
Yeah.
Possibly.
You know, there's themes here, right? Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, or...
From what I've seen so far, Dany, I don't think so.
Well, we'll see, because I've said a lot of, like... Or, actually, I won't say I've said a lot of I don't think so's, but I felt like I really don't want them to. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I really don't want them to. I really don't want Jamie to turn into another shit, which he already did. I really don't want...
We'll talk... I have more... Yeah, definitely. We'll add to that.
So, Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if, in the long run, Danny does not become a master that these Unsullied would like to remove. But anyways, Danny and Barristan walks into the tent, interrupting their foreign language class, telling them it's time. Time for what, though?
Time to invade, from what you see. It looks like they're crawling up the beach.
Yeah, but it's not like a full onslaught, though. They're sneaking in, right?
Yeah, it looks like an infiltration. Yeah, this is kind of how they've taken just about every city. They haven't really done any pitched battles yet, have they?
I don't think so, no. Everything's been pitched their way, for sure.
Yeah,
starting
for sure.
With dragons. But you think that a gate into the city would be fucking secured?
You would think.
I'm just saying. You know, well, because it's like these storm drains or, you know,
maybe
sewers.
It's not something people are supposed to know about, but then they might have had, you know, slaves on the inside or...
Not know about is plainly on the outside of the fucking walls, man.
I'm just saying that maybe there is some outside intervention or maybe inside intervention, depending on how you look at it.
That's a possibility. So they come in and they are dressed as slaves, right? And they introduce themselves to these slaves who are debating about what?
I love this debate. I definitely get into this debate. I don't think... They're basically debating whether they should even do some kind of revolt. And everyone's like, this revolts have happened before. But how many times have they happened with an army camped outside?
That's true. They probably never.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, there's some merit to their argument, right? So...
And they specifically mentioned the children that were...
Right, the 163 mile markers, I guess is what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But every rebellion ends in the same result.
Dead slaves and masters.
Masters in control.
Yep.
Grey Worm and his team of infiltrators show up. But I promise you, a single day of freedom is worth more than a lifetime in chains.
I completely agree with that statement.
I completely agree, too. I have not ever... Well, the closest I've come to not ever having freedom was in the military, so I'd enlisted for a contract, right? So it wasn't quite slavery, but the alternative to leaving of my own, you know, deserting was unappealing. So it might as well have been, you know, I guess it's close. It's almost like indentured servitude.
Yeah. But it was just servitude that you signed up for.
That's right. I volunteered to do that. So, yeah. You know, of course, I wouldn't even dream of comparing it to actual slavery. I'm just saying the closest that I've ever come would have been my enlistment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it does feel like there's no escape. And even though you have a lot of degree of freedom when you're deployed in combat zones, you know, there's not a lot you can do to get away. And if you did get away, then you'd be paying hell for it or, you know, on the run the rest of your life.
Not a good option.
Which is not a good option.
And that's a slavery or a form of slavery.
But I can tell you what, I enjoy my unenlistment a hell of a lot more than I would have, I think, if I had never been enlisted.
I don't know. I'm enjoying my never having been enlisted quite a bit.
But you don't know. You don't know.
Yeah, I don't know
how
for sure.
Good you have it. You don't know how good you have it.
I'm just going to take your word for it.
Take my word for it, trust me. So after Grey Worm introduces himself as, you know, an Unsullied, they're like, well, hey, man, yeah, you could set yourself free, but, you know, you've been trained since birth. Again, we come back to that. You know, they do a good job of kind of bringing information back in front of the Watchers' minds, you know, because we're talking about how...
I wonder why
they're
pressing that. It seems like they would have to have a reason to press that, but maybe they were just trying to highlight again how badass the Unsullied are.
Right, I think they're highlighting the story of the Unsullied so that when we had this scene with the slaves and have more weight to it, because they're like, hey, we're not trained to fight and we have no weapons, but guess what, we's brought's weapons.
I like that line, though. You know, we're not here to free you. we're here so you can free yourself,
right? Well, there is some merit to that statement. So no one can give you freedom, you have to take it, right?
Exactly.
And I think you know how much I like taking fiction and using it as a lens to kind of comment on our own reality. If you take that and apply that lens to, like, say, Iraq, where we went in there and we disposed of a dictator and then we handed them fucking democracy. It wasn't...
The closest I can think of that is when you blow up a balloon, when you take your mouth off of it and stop providing pressure into the balloon, the air just rushes back out.
That's a very good analogy. Also, did you notice? I saw white people as slaves.
Yeah.
I saw at least one or two in this scene. There are white people. You know, that was a complaint from previous seasons where it's like, wow, they set free all these slaves. They're all brown.
Yeah. And look who's the one white woman leading them.
Right. So it's kind of, you know, it wasn't very, there wasn't a lot of social equity there, I guess.
I will say, though, in a situation like that, how much social equity would you really see?
There wouldn't be social equity, but this is not reality, right?
Yeah.
It's a fantasy. We have dragons. So if we're going to be fantastic,
Might as well be equally fantastic.
Right. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's necessary. So people can put down their hackles. As a creator, you have an awesome, like, so Hollywood writers, film producers. I think as creators of entertainment, you have an awesome opportunity to equalize these social inequities that happen in real life.
Oh, yeah.
And I think when you don't take advantage of these opportunities, you're kind of failing.
I think I agree with that. Because what basically starts maybe as in something that's unreal, what are the barriers for that to become
real? Right, this is not historical drama.
You can at least make it at least something acceptable in culture.
Right. So, yeah, I think...
By showing it, repeatedly.
If I was creating these things, I think I'd push that envelope, you know, get more... So we transition from the conversation. They throw the weapons on the ground, and then we see a master and two guards walking in the city street, and he comes across...
This is something I'm always questioned about, because I see the guards, and I'm like, who the hell are they? Are you trusting slaves, clearly just offered the opportunity to freedom?
We don't know if they're slaves or not. Do they have collars on? We can't tell.
They don't appear to have collars on.
So they may be paid like mercenaries.
Yes. However, you'll see later.
Right. The message is written on the wall, and it looks like with blood, but I don't know. It could just be tar or something.
I didn't see any bodies or anything.
Because it said kill the masters, right? And then they pan and tilt up, and I thought, we're gonna see the body who's the blood it's.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
But you know, they put the focus up on top of the ziggurat with the harpy up there, and I was like, what the hell is up there?
It looked obscured, but it's hard to tell from that distance.
If they had shown the ziggurat at the beginning without the banner up there, then I would have been like, oh. That's Danny's banner, which, you know, they showed at the end of the scene, right?
Yeah, they kind of highlight that.
Yeah. Speaking of the guards, so...
Notice when those slaves came rushing, those guards disappeared
pretty... I didn't see them anywhere. Where did they go?
You see... The slaves were coming one way, and you see the guards disappearing past the slaves. I actually saw that.
So they walk past the slaves?
Oh, yep. I didn't see them going down. I clearly saw them walking past
the slaves.
That may
lend some credence to a theory that maybe they are slaves.
That's what I was thinking.
So if they are slaves, then they're like, okay, yeah, there's no reason to this schmuck anymore.
Yep. He's not going to be alive for much longer. I don't know why they didn't just turn and stick him themselves.
Yeah, I don't know. All I know is that I didn't see the guards anymore, and I was like, what the fuck happened to the guards? Because, you know, they had the three alleys, kind of, or the three directions.
Yeah, I was specifically watching. Now, down the first alley, you see the slaves rushing, and down the second alley, then you see the actual guards disappearing past the slaves coming.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It didn't look like they were being killed, but it looked like they were just, like, slipping past.
But that's what I like about... You know what I like about this scene? In, like, 30 seconds, Marina's freed. We're done with this city. Danny can move on. But
I did like that pan out, slow pan out from the banner draped over the harpy and then just kind of down to Danny. It highlights the size of that ziggurat.
Yeah, it was there's some good cinematography going on in Game of Thrones. I told you that number would be back, 163. I knew that they wouldn't drop that number and not use it again.
Yeah, that's true.
What did they do 163 times this time?
Well, you see, Danny first comes like past all the slaves and up to this... Basically pavilion. I think that's on top of the wall. It looks like it's on top of the wall. Based like where they originally were sitting and staring down while she had her champions fight or whatever.
It's definitely an entrance or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you see all those. It didn't look like 163 people there, though. Didn't look like 163 nobles standing there.
It looked
there.
Like a couple dozen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, a few dozen.
And then...
There is 163 masters crucified on the steps up to the entrance of Marine.
Yep.
And boy, the screams were... Wow. That one guy... There's like one guy who just kept screaming. That was some...
I think I would be screaming, too. Let's just
be
honest.
I'm just saying that was good acting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Way to be an extra.
Before she crucifies the 163 masters, Ser Barristan has some advice, and he's like, sometimes it's better to answer injustice with mercy.
Yeah, I loved her response to that. I'm going to answer injustice with justice.
I think there's credence to both philosophies.
Yeah, because what is justice but vengeance by a third party?
Well, yeah, the third party should be...
impartial and biased or unbiased and all that stuff, but
which she obviously isn't. I'm kind of the vengeance kind of guy. I don't mind vengeance, but it depends on your end goals. She would probably have more support from everyone. Well, I don't know. I take that back.
I think she'll have more support.
Slaves would definitely, because you know the slaves outnumber the masters. They already said that 3-1.
So they definitely got the support of the majority.
That's right. I guess that's all that matters. I think each path there has value. Sometimes you know maybe mercy is the answer. I wonder if Danny will.
I agree, but. Not that way, no.
Do you think Danny
not
will
in
ever,
that instance, I don't think.
Do you think Danny will ever show mercy to the unjust?
To those who do injustices? Probably not, and I hope she doesn't.
Well, we'll see.
I want her to take a hard line. Let's show that fist.
Maybe that hard line turns her into the tyrant that I was talking about earlier. Kill the masters, you know what I mean? So you can't always take the hard line, I don't think. Not survive the Game of Thrones.
When you're leading a slave army, that kill the masters is kind of a must.
Well, we'll see. So after the sacking, can it be called sacking? The
revolution?
Yeah, the rebellion of Meereen. We go to King's Landing. And I was surprised. Well, actually, I wasn't surprised. So we see Jaime and Bronn sparring again, right? At first, I was kind of like, wow, they're working together. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. Bronn's just a mercenary. Of course, they're still working together. As long as there's gold, he'll be there. So while they're sparring, it almost looks like they're kind of even, right? So they keep advancing. Retreating, and Jaime's starting to smile, you know, like, yeah, I've got the hang of this now, except for, you know, Bronn removes his fucking hand, the gold gilded steel hand, and totally backhands him with his own fucking hand.
That is totally a valid move for Jaime too, but this goes back into what he tells him.
I was thinking, you know, when they're going back and forth and it seemed like they were very evenly matched, I thought maybe Jaime was going to bring the hand out, you know, as like a parry, and so he could bring in the sword or whatever. But no, Bronn got there first.
Yep.
But now that Jaime realizes that thing's a weapon, we'll probably see him use it in the near future.
Hopefully soon, yeah. That puts some spikes in the knuckles or something. Just something.
Yeah. And then Jaime says, you're a rare talent when you're fighting cripples. Bronn returns like, you know, have you seen your brother? Oh, you haven't seen your brother, you know?
Oh, no. Did you talk to your brother this way?
All the time. He got used to it. You know, he asks him, do you think he did it?
Yeah, it gets a bit more serious.
What does Bronn have to say about Tyrion's guilt in Joffrey's death?
He just kind of sits down and he's like, that's not his style, basically. Yeah,
basically, poison or murder is not his style, right?
Yeah.
So he doesn't really have, I wouldn't say the guts to do it, because I think he's full of, you know, Tyrion has some intestinal fortitude.
Yeah, he's just, I think, a little bit more honorable.
He just doesn't have a taste for, you know, fucking killing people, man.
He's the god of tits and wine.
But yeah, and then that's where, you know, Bronn's like, oh, you haven't talked to him. And then he presses it, right? So he's like, do you know how me and Tyrion met? And he recounts the event there at the Eyrie where Tyrion was put on trial, but he wanted Jaime to be there, right? To be his champion.
Yeah, I don't remember that specifically, but I think they did as good of an issue of pressing that as I felt they did in the book.
I do remember that. Who's going to be your champion? It's like, well, of course it's going to be Jaime. And then she's like, no, it's going to be today. You know, that's when Tyrion's like, will anybody fight for me? And, you know, Bronn stepped up. He's like, I'll stand for the dwarf. And then he totally owned that fucking knight.
Yeah. So. Not even a chance.
Nope. And I think that definitely hits home with Jaime. And it's hard, damn it. I want to like Jaime.
Yeah.
I want to like his character development, you know? But, goddamn!
Rapist and child murderer.
Attempted child murderer. Child mangler, I guess would be an appropriate term. He did cripple Bran.
That's true.
So Jaime does end up visiting Tyrion, so the conversation with Bronn obviously did something. Something about this episode. Seems like every development has an immediate payoff. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, they definitely cut straight from like talking about it to doing it.
Right. Bronn talks to Jaime about visiting Tyrion. Boom, Jaime's visiting Tyrion.
It doesn't really cut to a new character to go through their stuff and then come back.
Yeah, no, it goes straight to it.
Yeah.
So while he's in the dungeon sitting down talking with Tyrion, he's recounting another moment of his life, and that's when
tied to a stake in the Stark camp.
Yeah, tied to a stake covered in his own shit.
Yeah, with a direwolf circling him.
And Tyrion's like, is that supposed to make me feel better? And Jaime was like, sort of. This ain't bad. But man, so they really actually go at each other during the scene. So Tyrion kind of throws, you know, his incest in his face.
Kind of,
you
know, pokes that. Oh, yeah, just Cersei's son, huh?
Cersei's son? Right. He asked Tyrion if he knows what's up, basically.
Yeah.
And Tyrion's like, I know the whole country thinks I'm guilty. I know one of the judges has wished me dead more times than I can count, and that judge is my father.
That's gotta hurt.
It does paint a pretty, you know, a pretty bleak picture.
You nail it right on the head, too. I'm sure Cersei doesn't even want a trial. She probably just wants somebody to kill me.
Yeah. Jaime actually asks him, because he needs to know, right? Jaime needs to know, did you kill him? And Tyrion kind of leads him along. He's like, oh, well, the Kingslayer brothers. Don't you like the sound of that?
I kind of like the sound of that.
I do kind of like the sound of that. It's kind of neat. And then he brings up the Cersei thing. Basically insinuating, you know, like, are you going to kill me now or what?
You want to just turn my back so you can go ahead and do this?
Right. "Are you really asking if I killed your son?" is what Tyrion says, and Jaime responds with, "Are you really asking if I'd kill my brother?" At this point, I don't really know if I'd put that past Jaime. In the right circumstance, yeah, I think Jaime would totally...
everything that's happening now leads me to believe that in the last episode, they did not think that was rape.
Well, of course, which is bad. Bad, bad, bad on the director's part. Or the whole cast. Somebody should have said something. I don't know. He's like, "Are you here to help then?" He's like, "What do you want me to do?" And he's like, "Well, help me escape.
Get me out of here, basically."
But Jimmy's like, "Yeah, I can't do that." And he's like, "Oh, I'd forgotten. I'd hate for you to do something inappropriate," which is, of course, linking back to all the incest and, you know, throwing Bran out of a fucking window and everything else that Jamie's ever done.
Yeah.
And then they start talking about, you know, even if the murderer came forward, threw himself before the throne, provided irrefutable evidence of his guilt, Cersei still wouldn't let him off the hook.
Nope, I think Tyrion nettled Cersei one too many times.
Yeah, it's kind of like, she just needs an outlet. And the outlet is Tyrion, and she's made that choice, and it doesn't matter now. What else happens?
I think that's part of just the events that kind of interjected Tyrion into this whole mess. Him being made King's Hand while waiting for Tywin. Just like him ending up in the situation and... entirely. I think Cersei kind of like a press on Cersei's power, and she did not like that.
Yeah, I think I can see that point. Before the scene ends, Jaime's like, "Well, you know, it must have been Sansa or something like that." And Tyrion's like, "No, it wasn't Sansa. She's not a killer yet." Foreshadow! I'm just saying. So it's either a foreshadow that she is going to become a killer, or a foreshadow that she's going to be blamed.
Yeah. At this point, I don't think she's going to kill anybody.
Tyrion's right. She's not a killer yet. Until Baelish pushes her too far.
No, that girl's been pushed quite far. I don't think she has it in her.
We'll see. Yeah, but she's not had opportunity either. She's had the thumb screws applied to her.
That's true. We'll see. I still don't think so.
I think given an opportunity to defend herself and, you know, put a fucking maybe weapon in her hand.
Maybe defending herself. Maybe.
Yeah. Put a weapon in her hand, I think she could kill somebody. Or if she sees another family member in trouble.
I don't think so.
I think so.
I think she'd stand there and yell. Maybe cry a little bit.
Nope. I think after knowing what happened to Rob and thinking Arya's lost and her mom's dead and her dad's dead, I think that if she saw another family member in peril, she'd act. So after the dungeons, we go at sea with Baelish and Sansa, speaking of. So yeah, again, so it's like we're talking about Sansa, we go straight to Sansa. A lot of setup payoff in this episode.
I think that's that's clearly the way they should be doing it. Follow one thread, at least for a while.
I'm not disagreeing.
You'd be on that entire story the entire time, but there's got to be some natural point where you can just kind of jump to another character.
Well, I mean, but, you know, sometimes you do want to build suspense. At the end of this scene, I think they could have done with a little bit of suspense, but we didn't get any suspense at the end of the scene, and I'll cover that when we get there. But at the beginning, we find out, hey, Baelish is going to go to marry Lysa, right?
Yeah.
The Eyrie. They're going to the Vale right now.
I don't know.
What is the fucking time frame here? In my Game of Thrones mind time span, it seems like it's been months since he said he was going to the Vale.
He said he's been to the Vale, and he apparently came back to pick up Sansa.
Oh, I guess so, yeah. So maybe he's been there. Okay. All right, so he's been there plotting shit, and then he comes back to see the fruition of his plots, and bam, picks up Sansa.
He definitely killed. After that little speech he gives, he definitely killed. I'm pretty sure he killed Joffrey.
Oh, well, there's no... I mean, he didn't do it, but he definitely put the players in place to do it.
He had a hand in it, yeah.
Yeah, so he orchestrated it. Not only...
Sad. Not sad about it, though.
Not only did he have Joffrey killed, he had Joffrey killed, he also set up Sansa. Did you hear that? Because he's talking about the necklace.
Oh, yeah.
They had a missing jewel, right?
Yep.
And they're going to find the jewel and must have held the poison or... I don't know what the hell it was. But I think that he's obviously setting up Sansa to force her to do whatever the hell he wants to do now. Which is odd, because he's going to marry Lysa. What does he want with Sansa?
Well, he obviously now wants her under his thumb, at least. He's now a lever. Sansa can't now go back to King's Landing and Tyrion.
No.
That's for damn sure.
Yeah, no.
Burn some bridges on the way out of there for her.
But she's not going to be able to go anywhere. Can't go to Winterfell, obviously. Even if she wanted to, I don't think Baelish is going to let her do anything.
Nope.
He's going to be basically holding her hostage, I think.
He's going to be, his way into the north. And he even said it, I want it all.
Yeah, he wants everything, right? And I think he wants to marry Lysa to get the lordship title, and then he's going to kill Lysa and marry Sansa. What do you think about that theory?
That's interesting. I think marrying Lysa, he's going to have an in into the...
Well, once he's lord, he's lord.
Yeah, but then you get the whole Eyrie and the north. I can't see him killing Lysa. I think that would make him too many enemies there.
Well, he's not going to just straight up with a dagger murder her.
Well, I know that.
She will die. I think that's his plan. She will die, and then he will wed Sansa, thus controlling the Vale and Winterfell.
That is a good point. Because, I mean, the kid is, so he'd be regent of the...
Yeah, he'd be king regent or whatever, right?
Yeah, yep.
Or not king, he'd just be lord regent.
And I wonder if he already has
instant. But, of course, Bolton. If that boy doesn't have titties to suck on, maybe he'll starve to death or something.
Or grow a bear.
Well, we'll see. He was talking about, so there's a big prolonged discussion about making new friends, right? So it was ridiculous for him to kill Joffrey. That's what Sansa's saying. It would be dumb of him to try to kill Joffrey because now he's going to make, when the Lannisters figure it out, they're going
to
want him dead.
He had nothing to gain.
Well, I've made new friends.
Yeah.
My new friends are predictable. And as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, it's the Tyrells.
Yep.
And guess what? No suspense, no mystery. We go straight back to King's Landing where we see Lady Olenna and Margaery talking, and she reveals that she knows Tyrion's innocent, right?
Yep.
Which means that she knew who killed Joffrey, which would mean that the Tyrells...
And... She even says, you don't think I'd let you marry that monster.
Exactly. You know, she... So Olenna is actually the ultimate mastermind. Baelish is the orchestrator, and poor Sansa is just a cog. But anyways, also during this conversation, Lady Tyrell is discussing her seduction of Luther Tyrell, how he was originally supposed to marry her sister, but she showed up the night before he was supposed to propose and fucked the hell out of him. And then, of course, all he could think of was Olenna and proposed to her instead.
She was supposed to marry a Targaryen. That's what she said, right?
Yeah, she was.
I'm not sure which was it. It couldn't have been the youngest Targaryen, the one.
Who
that,
knows? You got to think of the generation here.
Yeah, their marriage is of state, so I guess it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't know. They just said it was supposed to be with a Targaryen. They didn't say who. But she gives advice to Marge. You know, you did good work with Joffrey, but you need to move on Tommen. Basically, she needs to make her move on Tommen before Cersei can poison his ear, right?
I think that's a damn good advice.
It is damn good advice. But
Cersei
the other question
hates
is,
Margaery.
How far is Marge willing, you know, because, I mean, how old's Tommen?
In the books, he's like 9.
Yeah.
Here he looks quite a bit older, but...
Yeah, I mean, 12... 13, 14, something in there. Prepubescent, I would say. Which puts us again on some shaky, weird-ass fucking ground.
Well, Marjorie's
right?
She's only like 13.
If I put Tommen and Margaery, the actors, next to each other?
Well, yeah.
There's an obvious age difference, and that's all that matters is perception.
Yeah, that is all right? True.
The book age and the Game of Thrones age do not match.
They've definitely compressed it from both sections, from both sides.
Right.
Although, Sir Barristan looks pretty old.
I wouldn't go far as to say elderly. He's late middle-aged. But,
Sir Jorah.
But I'm still, Margaery putting the moves on Tommen, it doesn't sit right with
me.
They're
probably going to be married soon anyway.
That doesn't matter.
I'm just saying.
In this world, obviously, there's exceptions. So there's arranged marriages. People get married at all sorts of different ages, but that doesn't make it right. You know what I mean? It's fucking weird and creepy.
Well, yeah, we're going by today's values, obviously.
Well, I'm going by any value. It doesn't matter. I think I would, you know, I don't know. It doesn't matter. I think it's weird and creepy.
It is.
Marge is taken a bit back by her granny's confession there, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I wouldn't let you spend your life with that monster.
She seems shocked by that.
Yeah. You know, the lengths Olenna's willing to go to see whatever plan she has envisioned in her head is pretty far.
This is perfect, because you never see her outside of, like, the gardens or anything like that. So you know she's got this, like, she's got...
An extensive network.
Yeah, of just people. It's awesome.
So after the gardens there in King's Landing, we go up to someplace more bleak at the wall, Castle Black. And we see Jon Snow and, was it Gryn, giving fighting lessons to some new recruits, right?
Yep.
And he's talking about how the wildlings fight with a lot of wildlings fight with two weapons. So he's going over the strategies on, you know, you have to disarm them. Oh, did you see Locke there? Obviously.
Yep.
As I saw his little head there. I was like, oh, the motherfucker's already there and he's posing as a recruit. This is totally like not how I saw it.
I was expecting like a full brigade with him. I wasn't expecting just Locke.
I don't know how many people we brought with him as recruits, because, you know, there's a handful of people there being trained.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's totally not how I envisioned things happening. But definitely an interesting twist on, you know, because he's obviously ingratiating himself to Jon Snow. But during the training session, Alistair Thorne comes in and breaks up the training. Do you remember why he broke up the training? What he said? He said, you know, you're a steward, so you need to go find a piss pot.
Oh, just putting Jon back in his place. I remember him. I didn't know that was the reason.
Yeah, so... Jon was actually made a steward, if you remember, in previous seasons by Mormont, Lord Mormont.
Basically, Mormont's personal steward, so he can be, basically he was grooming him for command.
That's right. So he was supposed to be Lord Commander, Jon Snow's eventual place in the Night's Watch was going to be Lord Commander. But now that, you know, there's no Mormont, Jon Snow's just a fucking steward, I guess. So you pluck poultry feathers and you change piss pots and make beds or something. I don't know what they do. But now we have some more rules given to us. Janos counsels Alistair that the bastard's well-liked, and because he's well-liked, he might consider sending him on the mission to Craster's Keep, right?
Yeah, and gives him a nice little reason why.
Yeah, because Lord Commanders are chosen democratically, I guess, by the Night's Watch. So the Meister can call a choosing. And they didn't give a lot of details, but I'm guessing, you know, everybody basically votes on who the fucking Lord Commander can be. And so Janos is telling Alistair, hey, maybe you should send him up there. Let the mutineers take care of him. So otherwise, you're probably going to be taking orders from him for the rest of your life.
Yep.
However short that may be. And then at the very end, we see Locke ingratiating himself with Snow. Oh, you can fight. And then he gives a backstory about how he was a game warden, but then he stole some kind of bird to feed his family. And then, of course, instead of losing a hand and sucking up to highborn cunts, he figured he'd join the Night's Watch, but he comes here and finds there's more highborn cunts.
Snow plays without them.
So we go back to King's Landing, and oh, surprise, Cersei's drinking.
She seems to be doing that a lot.
You know, I have another theory. Crackpot theory 472. No one kills Cersei because she kills herself from liver disease.
I like it.
It's going to be a huge plot twist. So we don't get to see a brutal murder, but we do get to see a painful, agonizing descent into death while her liver fails. Hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later.
She reminds me of some unhappy housewife, deeply unhappy, depressed housewife who's just angry at the world.
Except she's not nobody's wife.
Nope, now she's just
Queen Regent.
Yep.
What's there to be fucking mad at? I don't know. But there's a rapping at the chamber door that she refuses to answer until finally Jaime just walks in and she's like, you called for me? Or what did he say, your highness, or, you know, some formal greeting, which of course she's like, oh, so formal. And yeah, so you were talking about earlier about how everything that's presented in this episode, that the show runners.
This is a good example. Yeah. They are civil. Like, that's number right. One. Like, you don't be civil to somebody who raped you, and you especially don't call for them.
So yeah, it's almost like, well, it's not almost, it is. The show runners are acting like the rape scene from last episode wasn't a rape scene. Which we all know that it was a rape scene, so there was no consent. It's rape. Jamie's not being given that treatment in the television series, so I think there's some cognitive dissonance happening, you know what I mean? It's like, wow, you know, this is not the way...
Doubly so, should I like Jamie, should I hate him?
Right.
And it's like, this episode, if it was just based on this episode and I hadn't seen the other one, I'd be liking Jamie because of his actions here. But
right.
At the same time, it's like his character took a turn for the worse in my mind.
So Cersei's grilling Jamie over his protection of Tommen, right? So he's like, don't worry, you know, we have a guy out there. We're protecting him. And she's like, oh, just like you did Joffrey. And then she grills him about
I'm just going to say, she has a point. Jamie's like 0-2 right now for king protection.
Yeah, he's not a very good captain of the King's Guard. He's batting 0 for sure. But King's Guard, I don't think it's the King's Guard duties to prevent poisoning.
Shouldn't he have like some kind of taster or something?
Yeah, most, you know, historically regents have had food tasters. So here, fine young man, taste my food for me. If you don't die, then I will also eat it. It's got to be a shitty job, man.
That's a good plan, though.
It is a good plan. But then Cersei's grilling him about, you know, well, why'd Catelyn let you go? Well, you know, why'd she let you go? And he's like, well, you know why, because I promised to return Sansa.
Yeah, and this is where she kind of gives him a little shit. Oh, you promised, or did you make an oath? Give your oath on it.
Right.
And he's like, well, yeah.
And then, of course, that brings up Tyrion. I heard you visited Tyrion. And he's like, well, you know, I had to know for myself. She's like, well, what'd you find out? And he's like, he didn't do it. Which, of course, just angers her more. And she's like, if I told you to go hunt down Sansa and, you know, bring your head back on a pike, would you do it? Do you think he'd do it?
I think he'd write out whether he actually went to get Sansa or not. I don't know. I think he's regretting having stayed in the King's Guard and not gone back to Casterly Rock.
Yeah, he should have totally went back to Casterly Rock, right?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Poor choices. He makes lots of them. And then we go to Tommen's room. Tommen is not sleeping well. Something tells me he hasn't slept well in a long time, even before his brother died.
With a mother like Cersei, how could you?
And wall hangings. Did you see the boar in there?
Yeah, I don't think I'd be sleeping in Joffrey's room, not without removing a whole bunch of shit.
Is that the boar that killed Robert, his quote-unquote dad?
I don't know. I do not know. They didn't mention anything about it, but...
That would be...
It still got the bowl that Joffrey shot through it.
Yeah, I definitely would have removed... Why didn't he... He's the fucking king now. Why doesn't he just redecorate?
Yeah, it'd be easy.
He's probably scared to.
Hey, you. He probably doesn't know the extent of his power yet.
Well, he's probably frightened. And I mean, Joffrey tormented him, and we hear another story when, you know, Marge comes calling, right? You know, she's like, it'll be our little secret. And, you know, she's like, tell me a secret or whatever. Because Ser Pounce jumps up on the bed and he's a cat.
I was informed that he wanted a cat. Cersei wouldn't let him have it. And this is more book stuff, I guess.
Okay.
So Margaery actually gets him like a whole litter of kittens.
Oh, really?
He ends up naming them in front of Cersei. At least that's what I'm told. That's what I'm told anyway.
That would have been a nice little nugget. But we get this other nice little nugget talking about how Joffrey had threatened him, right? To kill Ser Pounce and mix up his entrails in his food so he wouldn't even know he was eating him. That's pretty fucking sick. And that's Joffrey's brother, man.
Tommen has had to live with him for quite a while.
I know. It's awful.
What other sick shit has happened there?
Lots of it. Who knows? Who knows, man?
If I was Tommen, I probably would have murdered Joffrey a while ago.
Tommen, but that's not Tommen, though.
No.
He's kind of a meek guy.
Yeah.
So, if Marge weds this guy, Marge would be the power of the throne.
Yeah. I could see her making Tommen a better guy, though. She could probably make him stand
up for himself. I think he'd be an alright king, to be honest.
I think he's been under other people's thumbs too long.
I think he'd be an alright king. Like, if Tommen was the king, I would not have a problem with it, because he seems like a compassionate young man.
Yeah. I think you just need to get him out. He's easily influenced, I think. If you put him under... He's been under too many people's thumbs.
Yeah. Well, he's obviously smitten by Margaery now.
Yeah.
Since she came to visit.
She has a firm hold on him.
Oh, yeah. That took quickly... Do you think Marjorie's going to have any problems getting by the four guards that they're going to post at his door?
Nope.
Probably not. They're probably paying the bills there. So then we come back to Brienne and Jaime. And Jaime gives some nice fucking gifts to Brienne.
Yeah. He gave up his Valyrian steel sword.
I know. That's crazy. When his father finds out, he's going to be pissed off. Oh, well.
But that's his way of...
That is kind of sticking it to him, right?
Yeah. Both sticking it to him and his way of, like, fulfilling that oath to...
Yeah, and he also gives her a brand new suit of armor. He knows Brienne's size well enough to have her giantess frame.
Uh-oh. That leads to, there was some allegations of him and Brienne on the road.
There were allegations, but then we actually saw shit happen, right? When they're in the hot springs or... The baths.
I completely forgot about that.
This leaves me to wonder if Jaime will eventually be pressured into going after Sansa.
That's what I'm kind of thinking.
And he'll actually have to face off against Brienne.
I can't see him facing off against her.
I can. He did push a boy out the window, and he did rape his sister at the foot of his...
Good point.
Dead, you know, dead boy's corpse.
Good point.
Okay. So...
point taken.
That would be interesting. So we move out. They're sending her off, but not alone. She's not alone. Who gets to go with her?
Ah, yeah. They got Pod.
Pod, yes. I'm so happy. I smiled this is probably the first time I smiled the whole episode, was when, you know, they're like, hey, you know, here's your new squire, Pod. I was like, he was beaming too. Did you see that? He was so fucking happy. He's like, yes. Not only that, so he gets to...
And he calls her sir.
I know. Well, it's like, sir might be appropriate. I don't know.
Yeah, Brienne didn't seem to take that very well.
It's just like, whatever, dude. There's another gift given here, right?
Yep. Pod gets given Tyrion's axe.
The axe from Blackwater. And then we see the sword, the running sword naming joke, right? So all good swords have names.
Yes, good swords.
And what does she name this sword?
Oathkeeper. I thought that was very touching.
That was a good name.
So that's exactly what's going on here.
Right, so that sword was given to Brienne, so, you know, it's kind of like Jaime fulfilling his oath to Catelyn. And then they, you know, Pod and Brienne take off down the road. But I wonder how long this would stay secret.
Probably not long.
Yeah, I mean, it was Bronn and Jaime out there sending them off, so we'll see. We'll see if Cersei actually hears about this. But I have to say, I think with Brienne riding off like that, leaving Jaime, I kind of feel like that's kind of like the last vestige of Jaime's honor leaving.
He did bounce a lot of stuff off her. I think that's kind of his consciousness leaving, too.
Yeah. Yeah, his honor, his consciousness, his redemption is taking a fucking hike right now.
Yeah, we're going to do something important.
It is, but it's no longer his. That's what I'm saying. It's like, so now he's pretty much left with nothing in King's Landing, except for his wretched sister.
Let's see how he handles that. I'm kind of curious how that's going to continue.
So we go back up to Castle Black, and we see Sam thinking, oh, why'd I send Gilly off? She could be eaten. So for those who don't know, I do a Game of Thrones death pool every episode, and I actually named Gilly or her son or her baby and or her baby to be eaten last episode. She was my death pool I lost. They didn't eat her. But yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Why the fuck, if you're concerned about her, why would you send her out to be possibly eaten by Thins?
Did they know about the Thins? They knew.
Yeah, no, they know.
They knew the Wildlings were raiding south of the wall.
The boy from the last Castle Black scene, when they're doing the training, he's like, I was the best archer in my village. Yeah, that's the kid.
But did that happen before or after Sam took Gilly down there?
That happened before.
Okay. I couldn't remember the exact
time. That happened before. I don't know. Maybe I have to go back. I think they knew
The Wildlings were south of the wall, but I don't think they knew about the raid.
So you think he sent her off until before that boy came in? Yeah. I may have the order out of my head. But yeah, but now he's fretting about it. Like, why did I send her off?
It was a bad decision.
He wants to go get her, but John's like, hey, you can't do that. We got shit we got to do here. And he's like, well, you ran off. And John's like, yeah, and you came and got me. So, you know, it's kind of like they've almost switched places or whatever. So, but they're discussing Bran, right? So yeah. Sam has told John about Bran and about how he's going north of the wall. And it looks like Jon Snow is looking at a map. I don't know if he's looking at a map. He's looking at a map to kind of figure out where Bran's heading.
Yeah.
Where he could go. And they're discussing Bran, and then Locke comes into view. So do you think Locke overheard any of that conversation?
That's what I'm kind of wondering. I'm kind of wondering how much of that Locke actually heard. I'm thinking he heard quite a bit of it, because they mentioned Craster's Keep, too, and as we see later.
Right. So I don't know if he did. Locke showed up to tell Jon that Alistair Snow says he can go, Craster's Keep. So he goes, talks to Alistair Thorne. Thorne tells him, yeah, you can go. It's a good idea. I think you should go, but I'm not telling anybody else they have to go, so only volunteers. Of course, John's like, hey, you know, I need to go do this thing, kill these guys, the mutineers at Craster's Keep, so that the wildlings won't know our forces.
He seemed kind of hesitant at first as he started his little speech, but he got stronger there at the end.
Probably hesitant because he was worried that no one was going to volunteer. You know, who the hell wants to go? Because they barely made it out the first time, right?
Yeah.
So he can only take volunteers. He asks for volunteers, and his friends, of course, stand up, and who else stands up?
Quite a few other people, actually. Not most of the room, but definitely a few people that not on it.
But
list.
One recruit stands up, and who's that?
That's Locke. That's why I'm thinking he heard what they're talking about.
But here's interesting. So at this point on the party to go forth to Craster's Keep, there is only one known traitor, which is Locke. Because anybody he brought with him would also be recruits.
But the Locke is one of the last people to stand up, isn't he?
That's what I'm saying.
So, yeah, but a lot of other people stood up first.
What I'm saying, though, is John only pointed out Locke as being a recruit.
Yeah.
It wasn't until Locke stand up when he's like, I can't take a recruit with me.
Yep. So I think Locke's the only one that's... I think Locke's by himself.
That's interesting, because I figured he'd come there in force.
Yeah.
Or at least with a small group.
Or at the very least, he came into Castle Black just himself. I wonder if he's got other men stationed somewhere else.
So here's another question. Does Thorne know who Locke is and what his intentions are?
I don't think so. It seemed like he was just like, go ahead.
Well, I mean, he's hoping John dies, though, right?
Yeah, I think he would have made sure that he would have been more enthusiastic about Locke going if he had known.
Well, I mean, he didn't deny it.
No, but you got a point there, though. You do have a point, because, if I
play it up too much.
That was a chance to stop someone from going with John, increasing John's likelihood of dying.
Right. Yes, exactly. So why send a recruit? So we go up to Craster's Keep, and wow, what a den of depravity. This scene should have been in the last episode. They would have been in good company. It looks like Craster's daughter wives are wishing they had Craster back.
Yep.
Because there's nothing but a bunch of fucking rape going on.
Yep.
And Carl, the king mutineer there, is drinking from Mormont's skull.
That was a bit much.
Yeah, that was crazy. This is like very cartoony villain shit.
Yes. Well, he's sitting there talking about how great an assassin. The dude's clearly drunk. Talking about how great an assassin he is.
Well, before that, he's like, you know, what commands do you have, Lord Commander, or whatever? And he's like, fuck them till they're dead. Fuck them till they're dead. That's pretty crass, man. But then he tells the one guy to go feed the beast. When I first heard that, I was like, are they talking about the White Walker that Craster sent?
Yeah, this is very weird, because I didn't know what they're talking about either.
Yeah. And we don't find out till later. One of the women comes in with a boy. This is the last of Craster's boys. Carl's already just basically stabbed the damn thing.
Well, this is, it goes back to him pretty much saying, I'm the best goddamn assassin ever. And Jen Alley.
Yeah, he was full of himself. I don't think he's the best assassin ever.
I don't think he's the best assassin anyway.
I think he killed one guy by stabbing him in the back, and that was Lord Mormont.
Then we get that nice creepy scene of all the girls saying,
oh,
give
yeah.
to the gods.
Gift to the gods. Gift to the gods. So these people view the White Walkers as gods. Oh, that's interesting. Do you think that plays into any of the existing religious organizations that
not to my
we've encountered
knowledge.
So far? Yeah, not to mine either.
Well, maybe this is the fire god's enemy, the darkness or whatever.
Right. So
Lord of Light and Lord of Darkness, right?
Maybe yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they're the Lords of Winter or whatever, Lords of Darkness.
Lord of Light, Lord of Night? I don't know.
Because you have light, fire, night.
Right, that would, yeah, they'd naturally be at odds with ice or cold. Yeah, I don't know. We haven't been given enough exposition on how the White Walkers fit in with the religions of Westeros yet. They send, what is the name, Rast or something like that? They send Rast out with a babe. Rast sets it down. So he goes to feed something, right? And it's
yeah.
Ghost.
It is the direwolf. John's direwolf.
Yeah, it's Ghost. Which is surprising. I don't think we ever knew that development, that they had captured Ghost.
I can't even remember the last time you see that direwolf.
Last time I remember the direwolf was when John was running with the wildlings.
Oh, yep. That was way south of the wall, though.
No, that was after he was captured. So they're north of the wall, Fist of the Northmen, right?
Oh, that far.
Yeah.
I thought you meant when they actually climbed the wall and everything. And
no, it wasn't when they were climbing the wall. It was before that. So you could see Ghost off in the distance when he was running through the highlands there. Ghost must be the beast. So I was totally confused. I thought the beast may have been the White Walker. But no, Ghost is the beast that Carl was referring to. And the whole time he's doing that, I'm thinking, this wolf's going to get out and everybody's going to get it.
Yeah, I was hoping. I was
that,
so hoping.
That was what I was hoping. But no, I was disappointed. But then we hear the babe crying, right?
Yep.
And off in the woods, Hodor hears it. Hodor. And everybody wakes up and like, what's that? It's a baby crying. And so Bran wargs into Summer, and then he finds what?
He finds Ghost, but he also seems to, he runs Summer right into a trap.
Yeah, they must have been expecting that. Yeah. I wonder how they were expecting that.
Maybe that's the old traps left over from capturing Ghost.
Maybe. Or maybe they're a trap in case it gets out. So then, of course, they have to go free Summer. And then while they're on reconnaissance, they're checking out Craster's Keep. They're like, well, these men are the Night's Watch. Until the one begins to rape a girl. They're like, no, this is not, the Night's Watch. Yeah, we have to get out of here. And then they get up to leave. Or actually, they send...
Well, Bran's like, I'm not leaving.
They send Mira off to scout out where Summer was, right?
Yeah.
And then she gets cracked in the face.
That's
by the pommel of a sword or a butt of an axe or something. So they're captured, and then the next scene kind of breaks my heart because Hodor is chained up and they're taunting him, right? And then someone spears him in the fucking leg, man.
I think that's going to come into play hugely.
Yeah, they kind of spent some time with him looking at the blood on his hands, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you think Hodor is going to rage out? He's going to go all barbarian and rip people's heads off?
I hope. I would love to see that.
Kind of hope too. Oh, I wonder if Bran will warg into him again.
That would be interesting to
because,
watch.
Because that Rast guy, or whoever it was that dropped the baby off, if I had your body, or your strength, or your size, or something like that, I'd be king of the world.
Yeah, that's
That's a good foreshadow.
Yep.
It is a very good foreshadow. So, you know, we might see Bran warging Hodor here, and Hodor on a warpath. That'd be interesting. But Carl's inside interrogating Bran, Jojen, and Mira, and they're playing the quiet game. Bran stands up to some smacking in the face, but then Jojen starts having convulsions, going into seizures.
That kid looks super sick, too. He's just all sweaty and everything.
Yeah, he's got issues. It must be part of the green sight or whatever he has. So Bran lets out the secret because Carl's holding a dagger to Mira's throat, and Mira's wanting to help her brother, but she can't because Carl's got a hold of her. So Bran lets the secret out. You know, I'm a Stark. I'm Brandon Stark. And that's pretty much where the scene ends because Carl's like, someone's like, oh, that's Jon Snow's half-brother or whatever.
Yeah.
And I guess this is, I'll take a moment here because in my social feeds,
my friends inform me that this is completely changes the entire storyline.
Right, this is a huge departure from the books, right?
Yeah.
Huge departure, because I guess,
from what I've been told, number one, Locke is never sent north.
Really?
Yep, Locke's not supposed to be at Castle Black.
Locke's not supposed to be at Castle Black. Bran never goes to Caster's Keep.
John never gets sent to Caster's Keep. By this point, I guess the Castle Black is already under attack.
Really?
at least from what I've been told.
So we have three huge departures from the book. It'll be interesting to see how they tie it all together, because I guarantee you they're doing it to cut weight.
I'm wondering if they're trying to cut CGI.
No, I don't think they're trying to
cut CGI. Because I've been told two different ways. One of them couldn't remember exactly, but apparently that Crashers Keep been wiped out by White Walkers, is what I've been told.
So how would that save on CGI? They can just show the
I don't know. Now the they're
ruins.
Yeah.
Take the Battle of Blackwater. They didn't use a whole bunch of CGI for that. I don't think they used more when the dragons than they did any kind of epic battles.
Yeah, I don't know.
In fact,
they've
stayed away from epic battles, right? It's pretty much they just do a cutscene, people fighting, and that's it.
Yep.
Or you hear it. You hear it in the background, people fighting. Or you see the aftermath.
Yep.
So they don't really show battles, and so, you know, I don't think that's why they cut it.
I don't know for sure. It's all speculation.
After this, we go further north of the wall, right?
Yep.
We see where the baby goes.
Yep.
And we see where White Walkers come from.
That's one awesome skeletal horse. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was one hell of an undead horse. They did a good job on that, making it look real. So we find Icehenge, or what I'm referring to as Icehenge. The big ice.
That's a good name for it. I like that. Yeah.
So we're Icehenge, and the White Walker puts the baby down on an altar in the middle of Icehenge, and then another White Walker shows up.
I don't think that was necessarily what we know as a White Walker. That didn't look like an undead sort of White Walker.
Well,
sort of thing.
I don't think White Walkers are not undead. That's never been said. Whites are undead.
Yeah, but the thing actually with the powers and the undead horse and everything that can actually reanimate people and has ice swords, because it seems like you have whites which are like just dead people, like the guy that attacked Mormont, right?
Right.
But you had
the guy that
the thing
brought
that
back.
Actually killed him and made him into a white.
That's a White Walker, which was the guy on the horse.
Yeah, but that dude is totally looks like an undead, the White Walker. This dude that actually picked up that baby looks like something else completely.
You're right. There was a difference. In fact, there was a conversation with, I had a conversation with my supervisor today, as a matter of fact, where he didn't think that the guy that brought the baby on the horse, he thought that was a white. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure they've established that's a White Walker.
Yeah. Or what we know as a White Walker.
So, but this other guy, well, he has similar features. It's blue skin, blue eyes.
Well, the White Walker looks like a dead person. The white features, blue eyes, but white, mostly white features, white skin, like looks
so you
like
think he's just
shot.
Like a white that's been around for forever? So maybe what we've seen so far
no,
weren't
I think,
White Walkers?
I think there are three tiers here to that.
Okay.
I think this is some kind of special, maybe the race that made the White Walkers in the first place.
It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. So, but this is how White Walkers are made, I guess. He touches his, you know, long fingernail to the face and you see the eyes turn blue. And then, of course, and then there's creepy baby noises over the credits. And you can hear, like, the sound of ice crackling, which is, or ice forming, maybe. Which, you know, I imagine is the White Walker, whatever the hell, transmutation going through the baby's body. Doesn't scream, though.
I thought that baby was dead at first. Like, it was, like, some kind of white coming up on there, but I don't think so. Not when they set that baby down.
So this is also a huge departure. Well, actually, it's not a departure. This has never been revealed in the books. So where White Walkers come from, or their origins, or what happens to this baby, I guess. From what I understand, just of reading my social media feeds, is that this is also not necessarily a departure from the books, but something completely new that book readers have not experienced yet. So this brings me to what I want to say about this episode. This episode really told book readers that maybe they should adjust their expectations a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're doing it. I don't know the reasoning behind it. It could be, well, you know, we need to trim the fat from the stories because we plan on having this done in so many seasons. Or it could be, you know, a budgetary thing, like you're saying, to cut back on CG. But I think if it's a budgetary thing, it's more to cut back on the number of cast members. And so that way you can retain cast members over a longer period of time.
I wonder if this isn't, like, something to switch out cast members to.
So, because what happens is if you have all these, if they brought in all the characters, you know, and a character, take Theon, for example. That's why we're seeing a bunch of the Greek shit now. Because, technically, I guess, Greek doesn't show up until way late. You know, there's, like, a whole book he's not in. If you don't keep the actors
he would
in
look
play.
Way old, yeah.
Well, if you don't keep the actors in play, what happens is they have to go find other jobs because they're not just going to sit around and wait for the next appearance in Game of Thrones. They're going to go away. So
then they might be unavailable by the time you come back around.
Correct. Or maybe they're just, hey, look, the television series is our own thing. It's closely tied to the books, but we want to make it our own thing, which a lot of creators do, and I usually don't have a problem with that, unless they say change something fundamental about the story. And not having read the books, I don't know if this was completely fundamental or if it's more like a Tom Bombadil, you know what I mean? So
removing an entire character just because he wasn't integral to...
Right, so the Tom Bombadil scene from Lord of the Rings books, it was kind of like a deus ex machina. So the hobbits were gonna die because they're getting eaten by the old oak tree, old man oak or whatever, and then Tom Bombadil comes and snatches them out. Not once, but twice. Also out of the barrel mounds. I think really it was supposed to illustrate how the hobbits were out of their depth, to illustrate how their skills were insufficient to deal with the threat at hand that they're tasked with. But really, but it also comes out as deus ex machina, and you kind of feel, or at least I did, felt less than satisfied with those scenes. And since you could take those scenes completely out and still maintain the story arc, they did. But a lot of fans were like, where the fuck's Tom Bombadil in his yellow boots? So, I don't know if this is, they're cutting unnecessary elements from the story, and, you know, it's going to be somebody's Tom Bombadil. It's like, well, you know, this was really important to me for whatever reason. But regardless, they have basically told, hey, book readers, you can't trust what you know.
Huh, this is going to be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, so, and I think that's awesome, because as a show-only guy, like, I'm not reading the books. I tried reading the first book. It didn't appeal to me. I don't give a shit what's in the books. I don't give a shit what's on the screen. So it'll be interesting.
I think there's a lot of cross things there, and I'm definitely making my friends keep me up to date with the differences. It's not, I still don't think it's worth reading necessarily, unless they somehow take a major path divergence or something like that, and it's probably still not worth the read for me.
But you had an idea, right? You wanted to put a call out to the listeners.
Yes. Basically, I would like anyone to basically give us their feedback on some of the show versus book differences, and you can email us at
facelessmencast@gmail.com.
Yeah, and give us, hopefully in a non-spoilery way, let me say it again, non-spoilery way, book versus show differences.
Yeah, so if any listeners would like to be part of our, what could be a future part of the show, book versus TV section of the show, write us at facelessmencast@gmail.com. Tell us in non-spoilery, possibly vague terms, what was different in each episode, and we'll feature your narrative on part of our cast.
Even just small details, like about the thing about Tommen and the cats. I really like that kind of information.
Okay.
And there was another thing about Pod apparently never gets Brienne's name correct and just keeps calling her Sir.
Oh, really?
Like, maybe not her name, but the title.
Right,
never gets the title. Sir Ma'am or Sir or something like that.
Feel free to write in about book differences that you know about between the television series and George R. R. Martin's work, and we'll discuss it here at the end of all our podcasts. Speaking of listener feedback, we now have a feedback section. I've collected enough feedback now that it makes it a requirement. So after last episode, we got a ton of feedback, most of it dealing with our stance on the rape scene. But before that, Laws, he writes a theory about the Iron Bank, which you said you agree with. According to Littlefinger, He did his research on the television series and gave a bunch of links to video snippets on YouTube. But he starts with, according to Littlefinger, before the Five Kings War, the Crown owed $3 million to the Iron Bank of Braavos and $3 million to the Lannisters. After Tyrion comes on board as the Hand, or actually, after he comes on board after being the Hand and is now the Master of Coin, he reveals that the Crown actually owes tens of millions to the Iron Bank, having borrowed extensively, supposedly, or, you know, we can gather that, having borrowed extensively during the Five Kings War. Also, Tyrion speculates that the Iron Bank will begin funding their enemies if not repaid. And then we also see them touch base this season when Olenna and Tywin are discussing the same situation with the bank.
This goes back to our discussion based on you think that Davos is going to pirate the money, and
right.
I think he's just going to straight up ask for it.
And that's what Laws says. He says, since Davos is writing in Stannis' name, it's more likely he's going to borrow from the Iron Bank of Braavos instead of steal it, you know, because obviously they don't need that kind of heat.
Yeah.
But the question is, if they did do that, and if Stannis did win, who would take on all that massive debt?
Yeah, stealing it's kind of like, if they find out it's you, it's a problem, but if not...
Well, no, what I'm saying is, so if Stannis borrowed money,
yeah.
And then they win, so they would inherit all the Crown's debt. They'd be massively in debt to the Iron Bank of Braavos.
That's probably going to happen no matter what.
True.
But I think that if Davos goes the route of actually stealing it, if he manages not to get caught and successful, he's got a lot of money that they don't have to pay back because they don't know who stole it. But if they go the route of borrowing it...
I still like the idea of stealing it, right?
I kind of like it both
I like the idea. I could see it going down both ways. Saying, "Hey, we want to borrow this money, but then steal it and make it look like King's Landing did it."
Oh, that would be interesting.
Yeah,
I can see it going both ways.
But Loss is probably right. He's probably just actually going to borrow the money. Xeno P says, "Thank you, thank you, thank you for showing that at least some men understand that this is rape." Talking about the controversial rape scene from last episode. Joan S. says, "I don't often go out of my way to comment on things, but I really wanted to say thank you to you guys for being among the very few males who came out saying this was a rape. Many are claiming she was willing, she kissed him, and a woman wouldn't kiss an attacker. Most are just hemming and hawing with, is it rape? It feels rapey, so it's so disheartening to see how many people either don't know what consent looks like or refuse to see this for what it was." Nina from ProjectFandom.com says, "I have a theory about parents being okay with their children seeing violence, but make them leave for the room to cover their eyes when sex is involved." This goes back to your commentary about people at the sequel to 300 or whatever in the sex scenes. She says this as a parent who doesn't have a problem with her kids watching violence in superhero movies or video games. She says, "I think something in our brain recognizes that sex is a possibility and really an inevitability, but no parent ever truly thinks that their child will be violent, at least not to the degree displayed in movies and video games."
I completely agree. And I think that the whole, I love video games, but I don't think they make you act in any way violent.
In some ways, I think parents consider that violence is make-believe. I'm sure I'm not explaining that well, she says. I mean, we both understand what she's saying.
Yep.
I disagree. I think that no matter what media influences you, now I'm not saying we should censor media, and I'm not saying we should blame media, but I have noticed a significant increase in violence after young children watch, say, the Power Rangers. So they watch Power Rangers, and what do? Immediately after Power Rangers, they start kicking and punching each other. It's all play. I mean, they're having fun. So before they weren't being violent, they watched Power Rangers and now they're violent. There is an obvious line of, I think, a serious causality and, you know.
Well, let me preface that. With the exception of, like, you get younger children that, like, there's a clear line of when they know the difference. Like,
but if you are exposed to that as a young child, does that build some kind of foundation as later a teenager and an adult?
I have no idea.
See, these are interesting questions, and I'd love to discuss them, and I don't have the answer. I will not say I have the answer, but I definitely think stories...
I have no children, so I cannot put in my two cents there.
I definitely think that stories and entertainment, media, video games, whatever, definitely has an impact on the way you see things and the way you behave. Can we blame them for our problems? Hell no. That's where I draw the line.
I just think for the whole thing about that, it's like more of send them out of things so you don't have to have a conversation with them about it versus...
Well, you know, that was my response. I think it was a Facebook discussion that we had. My response is, yeah, but don't we have it asked backwards? If we think sex is an inevitability, but like mass murder is not, then shouldn't we be tackling the situation that is an inevitability? Shouldn't we be having those discussions with our children earlier or at all? Some people just don't because they're too uncomfortable. But I think if that's why we tend to want to hide that shit, then we have it backwards because we should be unearthing that and exposing it and talking about it as much as we can.
I completely agree.
Jesse J, he says, "Really good discussion about that scene in today's episode, especially Michael's mini rant. I personally fall into the camp of people who feel that the scene was unnecessary and severely misguided." Jessica H says, "So happy to hear you guys' stance on the rape scene. I'm not against these acts being portrayed in entertainment, but to hear that the director speak to the fact that he felt it was consensual by the end is a perfect example of rape culture, and I agree with that."
I totally agree. I kind of feel like the fact that it was rape, I'm okay with them showing.
Right. So we're all right with rape being depicted in entertainment
as rape, but you don't depict that stuff as consensual.
And then not call it, right.
Yeah, and then not call it. And then not have the full bout of
consequences. Which is why we're having some cognitive dissonance now with Jamie because, you know, because they think it's not rape.
There are no consequences.
But they're portraying it like, oh, well, this was just like okay.
Yeah.
Ronnie P. addresses me personally in an email. "You need to find Jesus Boy and quit spreading that anti-man feminist propaganda." I'm an equal opportunity feedbacker, so, you know, I'll share that kind of shit. But I'll tell you what, Ronnie, ever since I had a daughter, not so much now, I've not always been this well-adjusted, but ever since I got married, and then definitely after I had a daughter, I am definitely a feminist. And all feminist means, feminists aren't trying to take men's rights away. What they're trying to do is give equal rights to women. It's all about raising, you know, giving equality. A feminist is not anti-man. They're just pro-equality.
All I can say about that is you have the golden rule, do unto others as you would have
done.
That's
right.
Yeah.
And I have a link in here that says GRM distances himself from the rape scene. And it was on some website called HitFix. And I'll post a link to that because I don't necessarily trust that source. But I'll post a link to that in the show notes so that people can read that. Moving on to this episode feedback, Christine says, I'm glad Game of Thrones derailed from the books. So many book snobs piss me off. It's a TV show for me, not a book. She rates it 7 out of 10, this episode.
All I can say is, I know having like read a lot of books and then watched a show, it pisses me off when when things don't go away the way the book is supposed to.
Right, because it breaks expectations. Anytime you break an expectation, you're upsetting someone.
Yeah.
And that's just human mental shit.
Now, I like the idea of providing more. Like, maybe a scene that wasn't in the books or anything like that. And I definitely think that there was a lot of that in this show already, as far as, like, watching some interchanges between characters that just weren't in the book, that I think provided more depth to some of these characters more.
Here's my stance. I don't get upset about this shit when there's a difference between the source material and some adaptation. Because, one, it's an adaptation.
All I can say is that makes me not to want to watch the adaptation, because I'd rather stick to the material that I prefer.
So you're a canon. You're a purist.
Yeah, because it's such cognitive dissonance when you have two different materials for the same thing.
I don't have that issue.
Especially when it's like two different, completely different timelines.
I used to be that way when I was a teenager, but then I grew out of it, Jesse. You should grow out of it too.
But it's like, okay, so you have one story, and then you have another story that's supposedly the exact same thing, but different.
It is a different format. You cannot provide the same shit. You cannot translate a novel to the screen, not to a television screen, which is a different format than a film.
Then all I got to say to that is, you can use the same setting, but don't call it the same thing.
As long as it retains the spirit and the themes of the original content, that's fine. That's fine with me. You can call it whatever you want. The problem is, if you put word for word everything that happens in the books on to the screen, you would have a snore fest.
I agree with that.
So, and then, you know, of course you have to deal with budgets and all other sorts of things. Like, there's so many other things. There's different variables apply to each format. If you took a film and adapted to it to a novel, first of all, it'd probably be more like a novella. If you wanted a novel length, you definitely have to add shit.
Yeah.
It's just, it's not a one-to-one, you don't have one-to-one conversion rates between different types of formats. And I'm okay. I've learned to accept that, and I'm okay with that. In fact, I like to see sometimes I like to see a director's or a comic book writer / artist perspective spin on the media.
See, I don't. I usually either read the book or I watch the show. I hardly ever do both. Case in point.
And I'm not saying that there's, you know, it's not like you should watch it all. I mean, if there's a particular format you like, or if you only like going through the experience once, that's fine. I'm just saying that I learned long ago to accept that the formats are different, and I experience each one differently.
Yeah, to that point, I hardly ever read a book more than once, too, so.
I rarely read a book more than once. I'm with you there. Thank you for listening to the Faceless Men podcast covering HBO's Game of Thrones television series. Remember, you can catch us on Twitter at FacelessMenCast, on Facebook.com/FacelessMenCast. You can find us on Google+, you can find us on Stitcher, and you can find us on iTunes. And if you don't want to search for everything, all those links can be found in one place at madbrewlabs.com. Just find the link at the top of the page for the Faceless Men podcast.
Valor Megulis.